Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting to order today. We are February 16th, and this is the committee, the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Welcome to our committee on this holiday that most people have. We have three bills that we'll be hearing today. I'm going to open a public hearing first on House Bill 2251. Mr. Brennan, tell us a little bit about this bill, please.
I'd be glad to, Madam Chair. House Bill 2251 directs the Department of Transportation to accept credit and debit cards for payment of taxes and fees for vehicle registration, titling, driver licenses, driver permits, and identification cards. We have yet to receive a fiscal or revenues impact statement on this because we only have it scheduled for public hearing, and it will likely have impacts on both of those. There is no amendment before us, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. I believe we have two of our esteemed ODOT staff in the room today, Mr. McClellan and Ms. Joyce. I'd like to join us, please. Give us 1 second while we close the door. Thank you.
People are very excited about your testimony.
Yeah. It's an esteemed part.
Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation, and I am here to testify on House Bill 2251. As indicated by committee staff, the bill would require DMV to accept credit and debit card as a method of payment for most of its transactions. We do have a project underway that would enable us to accept credit and debit cards in our field offices, and we have visions of a much larger replacement of our computer systems that would enable point-of-sale capabilities and other methods of payment in the future. That's in the distance, but it is a dream of ours right now moving ahead. The bill requires us to accept credit and debit cards for any tax or fee related to vehicle title and registration, driver licensing and permits, and ID cards. We accept credit and debit card payments today on online vehicle registration renewals, and if you pay your emissions fee at a DEQ office, you also are going to pay with a credit card most likely. We split the cost of those merchant fees at a DEQ admission station. Hundreds of thousands of vehicle transactions are completed by mail with DMV, which would not be part of what we're currently planning with our field office work. We interact with customers, millions of transactions, every year over the phone, through the mail, and in person. Adding this type of capability adds a significant IT component for us, and we've been working for quite some time to enable our field office to be able to accept this. We're in the process for our 60 offices to be able to accept credit and debit cards. The current schedule for us is by late summer, early fall, to pilot that in two of our offices, most likely in the Salem area. It's a little easier for us if there's any problems, if it's close. And at the end of that pilot phase, to start rolling that out statewide to the other offices. This topic came up during the customer service task force that was formed last year at your request. It was a bill in 2014. It was House Bill 4047. The task force looked at customer service in DMV offices, and this was one of their priorities for us, would be to accept credit and debit cards. We do customer satisfaction surveys monthly. One of the most common things we hear from people is, why don't you accept a credit or a debit card for payment in the offices? Customer service is a core value for us. It has to be, because we are basically the face and the voice of the state government in many ways, because just about everybody has some contact with DMV. So we take this very seriously. Today, in most of our offices, I think it's 56 or 57 of those 60 offices, there is an ATM, so I'm a teller machine, that's available to people, but they cost them $2.25 to take that money out of the ATM. But it's being used quite a bit. Somewhere around 220,000 to 250,000 of those transactions are done every year, and that fee is paid to a private vendor, not to us. But it's paid to the private vendor. When someone comes to our office and doesn't have cash or check, or maybe doesn't have an ATM card, they're leaving the office, which is inconvenient for them and frustrating. It takes longer for a transaction. So we believe the credit and debit card capability is just a common sense thing for us to be accepting. Critical to this effort is a budget request that we have before this body this year to pay the merchant fees, the fees associated with processing those credit and debit card payments. For planning purposes, we've estimated that about 70% of the transactions would be, if people had choice, they would use a credit or debit card to pay for those transactions. The rate can be from 1.5% to 2%. For planning, we've used 2%. We have a budget package that'll be in Ways and Means later this session. It's a little over $6 million for 2 years. So as you can see, we take in a lot of money at DMV. And so that fee, that 2% rate and 70% of the transactions adds up to quite a bit of money. Whether there is a service fee assessed to the person who presents the credit card or not, we still have that expense to pay. It's a cost of operation. So it's not a reduction of the revenue coming in. It's actually a payment that we have to make. So we have to put that in our budget to spend to make that payment. There are three ways, basically, to cover that cost. What's recommended, what's in the budget right now, is that the highway fund cover that. It's just a cost of operation. You can also assess people a service fee. Every time they present the card, they pay a little bit extra for that. Another option would be to raise our fees a little bit across the board to cover the cost of those merchant fees. But those are the three basic approaches I think you have in front of you in moving ahead. We ran those three options past the Customer Service Task Force, which had three legislators on that group. They recommended wholeheartedly that we not charge any kind of a service fee. And so with that encouragement and just moving ahead with this plan, we've decided to present it as a highway fund expenditure to cover those costs. So the bill as presented seems to be broader than what we're planning right now. It doesn't seem to specify field offices or through the mail or even over the telephone. It also specifies a certain type of transaction, and there's more things that we collect money for than what's listed in that bill. Reinstatement fees, trip permits, those types of things. So we probably want to talk to you more about what's specifically in that bill if you decide to move forward with that. So that's my overview. Just bottom line, we do have plans to accept credit and debit cards in the field offices. We're probably a good year away from having it statewide right now. The bill, as written, would take effect in January of 2016, which would be faster, I think, than we could even do it in the field offices. So with that, I'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Panel? Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks again for being here, for your testimony. I appreciate it. Could you talk about some of the bottlenecks right now? Because it's hard, I think, for me and the public to understand something that all businesses that I know of can go to a local bank or an online merchant and set up for a 2% or 1.5% or 3% fee almost immediately, set up a merchant system to accept credit cards. So could you just talk about what the bottleneck is with DMV and why a pilot program would be necessary and why a year implementation would be necessary?
Yes, Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Davis, for several different reasons. We want to do this right. And security is very important to us, making sure that we are doing the best we can to protect that private personal information that's collected as part of those transactions. Probably the biggest thing, though, is we have old systems. We have new technology coming in with credit and debit card capabilities, and that is technology that's in flux right now as well with the move to the radio frequency the chip on the cards. That's becoming the new standard in the United States. So we have to keep that in mind as we're moving ahead. We're bringing in new card readers, new software, and we are working with systems that were created in the 60s and 70s, and our new stuff is created in the 80s. So there's a lot of interface with old code that has to be fully tested to make sure it's working properly. So it's not that the technology of credit and debit cards is that new and innovative. It's the linkage with the old systems that we have today. We estimate over 300 of our programs have to be changed in some way to enable that kind of payment to be processed in the field offices.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here.
You mentioned that the focus group indicated that it wouldn't be a good idea to charge the service fee back to patrons. Can you give us some feedback on what their reasoning was with that?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, I think there were various reasons of the members. For the most part, it was just convenience. They thought we should be encouraging people to pay with a credit or debit card. It takes more time to explain to people that you have to pay a little bit extra. There's also additional cost. You pay the merchant fee on the service fee also, and we have to keep those separate. It's just the complexity of it, the impact on the public, and convenience, I think, was what they were mostly looking at.
Thank you. Mr. McClellan, do you have a sense? I mean, it sounds as though you already have a system in place where some of this can be done online, mm-hmm. and it can be done with a credit card. Do you have a sense of how many people will begin to transition to these online transactions for a convenience factor as opposed to going down to the DMV and accessing the staff that are at the window? If this changes, is there an incentive to not bring people into the office at all?
Chair McEwen, that would be our intent all the way along here. The more people that will do our business remotely, by mail or online, the better service we're going to provide in the field offices. Many transactions, people really have a choice. Like a vehicle registration renewal is the best example. Today, about 21% of people choose to use their online capabilities, but about 30 to 33% are still going to a field office. Doesn't make sense to me, but for many people, it's just convenience. They're used to doing it a certain way. In smaller communities, sometimes it's, I want to go check with Bill or Sally that works at the DMV office, and I'll do my transaction while I'm down there, and I'll pick up a cup of coffee on the way. You know, it's a social event.
Yeah.
So I think the more we can incentivize people to do things online, the better. It really is.
Well, and that begs the question, as an agency, how do you create that incentive? I mean, I register my boats online. I register my cars online. I've been doing it for a while. What's that carrot out there that could incentivize people to use the system differently?
Well, Chair McEwen, one of the things that the task force actually looked at was the possibility of a lower fee if you paid it online versus in a field office. And we've done a fee study, a cost-to-service study, and we determined that the registration renewal in a field office is about $6 more per transaction than it is online, even though there's a credit card piece to that mm-hmm. and mailing.
And that's the cost to you.
The cost to us.
Yes.
Cost to us. The task force, customer service task force, looked at that and said, well, we don't want to cut highway fund money by reducing the fee, you know, for the online, but the next time you raise your registration fee, maybe you raise it in tiers. Not as much for those online and more for those who pay in the field office. And there's maybe your incentive or disincentive. It doesn't take much to incentivize people to do things a little differently.
$6 is $6.
It is. And people will drive, you know, miles to get cheaper gas these days, too. So.
Yes, sir. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may have said this tonight. What's the average transaction cost?
It's a little over $100. I don't know exactly off the top of my head what that is. We take in about $200 million per year on those transactions. Everything from $1.50 for a record to several hundred dollars for a vehicle title and registration transaction for larger vehicles and things like that. So, but it's a little over $100 per as an average statewide.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Yes, sir.
And do we have any idea how many folks are accessing the ATM?
Yes, Chair McEwen, Representative Benz, it's about $250,000 a year. Those are the statistics we get from the private vendor that operates the ATM. And it's, like I said, in 56 of the 60 offices. It's not in every office, but just about everyone.
You mean that's the average per office, or is that the total across
total
the state?
Statewide.
Okay.
Total across the state.
Okay, thank you.
I guess I had one.
Yes, Representative McLean.
You've talked a little bit about the antique quality of your computer system, and so I guess timing is an issue. Do you think that your systems can handle this change of load to online services? And, you know, I mean, is the timing the right timing for the technology you have in your field offices?
Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, what we're doing right now with the credit and debit cards in the field offices is I hate to call it quick and dirty, but it very much is that. Working with the systems we have today, putting it out there as quickly as we can, but not as fully as we would like. For example, the receipt the person might get might be a total and not an itemized receipt. It takes more time to create that itemized receipt, so we'll probably just give them, here's your total, and that's probably all that they would need. The idea is we would build this, and then over time, as we replace our systems, we can put something in a bit more robust than just accepting the credit and debit card in a field office. Much more capability for our employees to be able to look up and see how much we should charge each person instead of calculating that. You know, sometimes it's on an envelope, you know, just writing it down, just estimating what the total is that they have to collect from the person. Actually having a point-of-sale system that helps us, our employees, do a better job with their customers.
Okay. And if I may, Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, so ODOT, on behalf of DMV.
Would you mind identifying yourself?
Thank you. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Thank you, Chair. ODOT for DMV has two policy option packages as part of our budget this session. One is the credit-debit piece to pay for those merchant fees. The other is what we're referring to as service transformation program, which we would be happy to come back and speak with the committee if it were the chair's desire. Mm-hmm. But looking at changing the way DMV really serves our customers, we are the face of state government, and trying to serve our customers in the way they expect to be served in modern society, a lot more online transactions, a lot more availability to pay with a credit card, perhaps over the phone, these other things that are contemplated in this bill but really are problematic with our current systems, to your point, Representative McLean. And so we are looking at attempting to modernize and are presenting that to as part of our budget for the session, moving forward in a way that serves customers the way they want to be served and much more efficiently and getting out of the 1960s and 70s.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Joyce? Representative Bentz.
No, thank you, Chair. I was just, it bothers me, the $250,000 number bothers me quite a bit. That would mean 2,500 people at $100 a transaction use the ATM out of literally bazillions more than that. So that means everybody coming in must be carrying cash with them. And so any argument that the 2% fee is offset by the ATM is not a good argument. And so I was just sitting here reflecting upon the $6 million or whatever portion of that is actually going to 2% is sure expensive. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. It's just I'm wondering who it is that's benefiting the most from the increased convenience. If it's us, well, that's fine. So that probably is my question. And does this help the folks at the desk a lot as opposed to people just handing over cash, or is it helping the person that otherwise would have to hand over the cash? Is it the customer or us? Who benefits the most from this? Just stop there.
Well, Representative Bentz, I think it helps both. I think it's mostly for the customer, especially if they're not charged an extra fee as part of that transaction. Right now, at an ATM, they're paying about $2.25 to get that money out, and sometimes it's multiple times because it's limited in how much money they can get out for each transaction. So they might do it twice.
But Mike, excuse me, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes,
sir. But just you serve far more people than 2,500 people, right? So my little assumption of $100 being that average amount. $250,000 being the amount paid to ATMs.
Excuse me. It's
do we need a clarification?
Yes. Let me clarify that. It's 250,000 transactions. 250,000 times people are taking the money out of the ATM. I'm sorry. It's not the total value of the money taken out. It's 250,000 times they're going to the ATM to take the money out.
And that is across the state in 1 year?
Yes, yes.
In 57 offices that have an ATM?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So they have established that they're going to save $2.50 per $100 transaction. We're not going to ask that they pay that $2.50 to us because we're not going to pick up 2%. Essentially, it's about the same. So we're not only making it easier, we're also giving them a $2.50 break. Well, mm-hmm. not really, because we're running around collecting money from the gas tax, I guess. Mm-hmm. Right. Is that what's happening?
So, Chair McHugh and Representative Benz, there's a savings to the person who now goes to the ATM, so they won't have to pay $2.25 every time they take it out. It's more convenient for people. The efficiency of the office, I think we could probably measure that as well. If someone gets to the counter, doesn't have cash or check today, they then turn around, walk around to the ATM, the person from DMV is sitting there waiting while they go to the ATM, get the money out, and they come back to finish the transaction. That delays the transaction, and people waiting, it takes longer than for them to be served.
But there's an efficiency.
There's an efficiency that comes mm-hmm. from that as well.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick on that regard, I've had that happen to me, and they move on to the next person, and I go back in line. So
yeah.
I need to go to the DMV you're talking about.
Depends on the office.
I too am having a hard time wrapping my head around the benefit if let's say it's $4 million that we're taking out of the highway fund, and I'm just throwing that out there because I don't know what you're doing on the 2% fee, then we're taking dollars from the highway fund to fund this to benefit our constituents, but then we're taking from them if you think about the state of our roads and all of those things. And you mentioned that there was then a cost for the merchant fee, but that's a really nominal fee when you do the math. Even on a $4 million, you're talking $80,000 to make $4 million seems to be a pretty good investment to me, especially when we've got folks that are already used to paying the ATM fee. I realize the focus group was against that, but I'm going to push back a little bit on that, I guess, and challenge that a little in that they're already doing that. So I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around the benefit versus what we're taking from the state highway fund when our roads are in such disrepair and we're going to pull millions of dollars out of that fund. So maybe you can help me wrap my head around that.
Chair McEwen and Representative Hack, you know, that is clearly a policy decision for this body to make. The bill was put, or not the bill, excuse me, the policy option package, the bill is that you're contemplating is not from ODOT, but the policy option package was put in without a fee based on the recommendation or the approval of the Oregon Transportation Commission and informed by the task force. But clearly, whether to charge a fee is a policy decision for this body to make as the Ways and Means Group looks at this package.
Welcome. I'd like to welcome Representative Lively.
Thank you.
I've been testifying in another committee,
I understand. Yes, I have. Thank you.
You bet. You know, I think one thing I don't want to lose sight of here is that, you know, we all, I'm going to make an assumption, have computers in our homes, and we upgrade them on occasion, and our school districts upgrade computers on occasion in our cities and our counties. And there's a point at which your system is so antiquated that just the age of the system itself begins to create all kinds of problems. And if your platforms are 80s platforms or 90s platforms, part of what I think we need to consider as we move forward with this entire topic is the price you pay for working on an antiquated system. So mm-hmm. I understand that a $4 million investment is a significant investment, but there's a point at which you can't function very well anymore when you have a system that's so outdated that you can't fix it anymore. So I think it's just something we want to keep in mind as we move forward with this entire topic, whether it's credit cards at the window and how ATM fees fit in, whether we try and drive people to their computer systems at home to do this in a more efficient way for the state and for the customer. I think these are all things we're going to continue to have conversations about as we move this topic forward. Any other questions for this panel? This is just a hearing today. We'll be revisiting this again and
Representative Lively, I know you came in at the last minute, but we have our ODOT staff here talking about the use of credit cards.
And I had an opportunity to visit with them earlier about it, and so I may have some additional questions. I don't have them right now, but I do appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Yes, sir.
Vice
Chair Gorsuch.
Do we know what other states do in this regard?
Chair McEwen, Representative Gorsuch, we did a survey 3 or 4 years ago, and we identified which states were actually charging a service fee. It was about 12 to 13, maybe 14 states. Most are accounting it as the cost of doing business and just absorbing it as part of the fees, paying for that cost. Utah, I know off the top of my head, has a separate fund they've created where the service fee goes into that fund and they draw from that fund all their costs associated with processing credit cards. And that fee is adjusted every year or two by formulas, and they share that with the legislature. So they adjust it to their actual costs. But it's kept as a separate fund, just dedicated for that particular purpose.
Is that the only state you know that's doing that?
It's the only one I know of for sure. And we got a copy of their statutes as well. If you were interested in that, we could share that with committee staff and you take a look at that. But
that would be appreciated if you wouldn't mind. Be a model that we might want to take.
Provide some accountability for separating that particular cost and the revenue associated with it to make sure you're not overcharging people and it's paying its fair share as you go.
Did you have another question?
No, that was it. Thank you.
It'd be interesting to know too, and I don't know how your models are designed, but is there a difference between Salem is always the example because we're here, so those are the offices that we hear about. When you go out into rural communities, is the cost differential different when we're upgrading systems out in Lakeview or we're doing it in Salem? Does it make any difference, or is a system in your regard?
Chair McEwen, it's not going to matter. The cost of that particular office and the equipment that we put into that office won't matter whether it's Portland or Enterprise or Coos Bay. It's going to be the same for us, the cost of what we install.
Across the system over the years, they've been upgraded essentially in the
sometimes,
schedules.
Sometimes there's some network issues. Some of the more rural areas of the state, we might have to beef up the network capacity to those particular offices. But for the most part, the equipment we install is going to be the same no matter where you are and what part of the state.
Thank you. Yeah. Any questions? Appreciate you being here. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2251, and I will open the hearing on House Bill 2482. Mr. Brennan, give us a little update, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2492 authorizes the issuance of pass-through revenue bonds for projects outside of the state of Oregon. It defines the term within the state in relation to the construction of structures by institutions eligible to receive pass-through financing under authority of the Oregon Facilities Authority. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. This measure, I should point out, has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. And we also have, I believe it's on OLIS and in your packet in front of you, a -1 amendment that adds some clarifying language. It clarifies that an institution within the state includes those that are owned or controlled by or affiliated under common ownership or control with an institution whose primary place of business is in Oregon or conducts a substantial portion of its business in Oregon. It replaces the term structure to be financed with real or personal property to be financed, and it also clarifies the measure does not prohibit financing more than one structure. That's what I have for you at this point, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. I have four people that have signed up to testify. I have Ms. Lockwood McCall. Would you like to start us off? And if you'd like to bring anyone with you, we have three other people who are here. I don't know if they're with you or not.
We're all here.
All right. Thank you. And it would be Ms. I'm not going to read this very well. Wyland, thank you. Ms. McLennan and Mr. Schrader. Great, thank you. Would you like to begin, Ms. Lockwood McCall?
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division, and as Vice Chair Davis stated, I seem to be here a lot lately, so my bill for just being here early in the session. One of the many things that the State Treasurer's Office coordinates in the debt finance realm is that there's been a conduit revenue borrowing authority for nonprofits in the state of Oregon that we've run through our office for about 26 years. And this nonprofit financing authority will finance on a tax-exempt basis the borrowings of large nonprofits in the state, most of our nonprofit universities and hospitals, as well as very small nonprofits. And we have a variety of programs. Our executive director, who is hired through treasurer's office, is having hip surgery today.
Oh, dear.
So she couldn't join us. I'm hoping that, for the record, her cover letter made it into your board package. And I'm just going to give you a few highlights from her presentation. Okay. We've also submitted our most recent annual financial report that you'll see here. And we went ahead and actually figured out, for most of you, some of the nonprofits in your districts or nearby your districts that have benefited over the years from working with OFA. As Gwen Griffith, who is our executive director with State, we've done $3.2 billion in tax-exempt bonds over the years. These are not bonds that are obligations of the state. We're simply a pass-through revenue bond. We receive no public dollars, and we collect fees from all the nonprofits as part of the financing transaction, which pays for all of our operating costs. And it's a seven-member board, and we are delighted to have two of our board members here to talk with you today that are appointed by the state treasurer. 2492 doesn't have the best summary as explaining what it is, and so I'll try and explain what our goal is. As I said, we finance facilities, both equipment as well as bricks and mortar, for nonprofits. There are a number of nonprofits in Oregon that also have facilities in adjacent states, or perhaps not adjacent. Several of our nonprofit hospitals, for example, have operations in Washington State, Idaho, or California. So they may be doing bond transactions in multi-states, and the logistics can be kind of complicated and costly for them for trying to finance and close deals in multiple states. What we'd like the authority to do is to be able to finance their out-of-state projects, but they have to be an Oregon nonprofit, but they would not get tax exemption on a state basis for those projects. That's what the summary should have said, but I don't think it quite said that. Okay. Again, it would only be nonprofits who are in the state that would benefit from this. Some of our board members will tell you why we think that's an important opportunity. And with that, I'll just let you know briefly, though, that we not only bank the big ones, big firms, as I mentioned, but also small nonprofits. We have a private placement program called SNAP, and we do small nonprofit financings. Basically, they take their private bank mortgage, and we're able to wrap tax exemption around that and lower their borrowing costs by at least 1%, in some cases 2%. So that's a big deal for them. And we're really proud that we're able to do that and provide those services. I mentioned before I turn the podium over that I have at least a couple of projects in each of your districts. So I'll have some nods of who we've helped over the years and who we'd like to continue helping. Our chair, we couldn't quite find one in Coos Bay, but the nearest project we found was Goodwill Industries Projects in Curry County.
Not my district.
Not quite your district, but it's as close
but
as we
close.
Can find. We'd love to have more, so
that's
this is also a marketing opportunity.
I wish it was my district.
Representative Davis, we had Luke Dorf, which is in Tigard. We've also financed projects for George Fox University in McMinnville.
Nice.
Representative Gorsuch, we've done University of Western States financing projects. Representative Vance, we couldn't quite get to Ontario, but we did get as far as John Day.
Nice.
We did Valley View Assisted Living.
Nice.
And we've also done work for the Deschutes Children's Foundation, which is in Bend. Representative Hack, we have done work with Willamette University, a number of financings over the years. And Representative Lively, we know Peace Health. That's one of the large nonprofit hospitals that's actually helped fund a lot of our operations. And then lastly, Representative McLean, we found Sequoia Mental Health Services in Beaverton. I'm not sure it's your district. But that just gives you a broad sample. I could have easily picked other members of the legislature, and we'd have a similar story. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our board members to introduce themselves and explain why the board and the director and the treasurer's office feel that 2492 would be beneficial.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Weiland. I'm Chief Planning and Design Officer for Providence Health and Services, but I'm actually here today as a member of the OFA board for the past 7 years. As Laura explained, Oregon has several large nonprofit hospital systems that operate in several states. Catholic Healthcare Initiatives is one, Peace Health, Legacy Health Systems, and of course Providence Health and Services. There are also several large retirement communities that operate in multiple states as well. So these nonprofits rely on bonds, such as those issued through OFA, to build facilities and purchase equipment, such as large electronic medical record systems. It's more cost-effective for a hospital or a retirement system to issue through one issuer for several different projects in multiple states. OFA's current statute does not allow this, so this bill would solve that problem and lower the cost of financing for those issuers, allowing more dollars to be allocated for services that we provide. Thank you.
Thank you for your good work.
Pardon?
Thank you for your good work.
Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives, and I'm here today also as an OFA board member for the past 3 years. One of the things that I want to illustrate is how the work that OFA does with its really large borrowers helps to support the work that it does for the smaller borrowers. OFA doesn't receive any funding from the legislature. It is an entrepreneurial business model with its own fees, generating the revenues that it needs to do more transactions. The biggest fees, of course, come from the largest borrowers. The largest borrowers are more likely to be these multi-state entities and transactions. But one of the things that that does is support the SNAP bond program that Laura referred to. That is a streamlined, efficient financing technique to do particularly small projects. The average size of a borrowing is about $2 million, and it's typically used to purchase buildings in which the services are provided. A couple of examples of those SNAP bonds include Goodwill Industries of Lane and Curry Counties, Morrison Child and Family Services in Multnomah County, and then in my business line, Innovative Housing, who financed three separate properties for a total of 172 units. These were properties that they had owned for quite a number of years, but it was time to go back and refinance the original debt, which was at higher interest rates, and by doing that, free up some funding to do renovations for the buildings to make sure they'd be affordable for the coming years. So, again, I support this bill and encourage you to do that. OFA has done some great work in the state of Oregon, and we hope that we can continue that in a robust fashion.
Thank you. Questions at this point from the panel? Okay. Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you all, and for Laura, thank you for your testimony. Maybe at some point after the final bit of testimony, you can just briefly walk through the mechanics of a pass-through transaction, the conduit transaction.
Oh, sure. Happy to. Mr. Schrader, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here this afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. My name is Mike Schrader. I'm an attorney in Portland with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. We serve as bond counsel to the Facilities Authority on this, and we support this legislation. As Ms. Lockwood McCall indicated, the function of the Facilities Authority is to lower the cost of borrowing for small and large nonprofit institutions. That occurs because a nonprofit institution can't issue debt directly and get tax exemption. And it's necessary to collaborate, to partner, if you would, with a public entity to issue bonds on their behalf. Again, there's no obligation on the part of the state or other entity that issues on behalf of the nonprofit institution, but that's what creates the federal tax exemption. And under Oregon state law, there's also a personal income taxation tax exemption for interest on bonds issued by the state. Been very strategic and very deliberate in this legislation to not allow the state tax exemption for any bonds that finance a project out of state. There's very much a trend in place across a number of states. Every state has something like the Oregon Facilities Authority. Some states have multiple issuers. In Oregon, we have it consolidated in a very competent, very capable board of the Oregon Facilities Authority, working with the state treasurer's office. But these issuers are throughout the nation. Some have very, very liberal, very generous provisions that allow them to issue bonds really anywhere. Again, this legislation is tailored and targeted to Oregon projects and Oregon issuers. So you have to have a nexus of the, if you're going to issue for a project out of state, there has to be a nexus. There has to be established business or facilities in the state. So again, it's very carefully crafted, both in terms of the required nexus for the Oregon issuer, and also in terms of limiting the tax exemption for Oregon projects. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What is the history of this process? How long has this process been in place?
Through the chair, OFA was established 26 years ago by the legislature. The initial project was the OMSI Museum. And it was originally, before it was called OFA, it was called HECFA, which I think, help me, is health,
housing,
and something else, but it was too long.
Facilities.
So several years after it was established, it was consolidated to call the Facilities Authority. About 4 or 5 years ago, I think the legislature expanded our authority beyond just the healthcare and housing, and we can do banking for any nonprofit. And so we started seeing a lot of social services, small social service agencies. We do nonprofit K-12 as well. We've done I was thinking in the K-12. We've done the French American,
German
American, French American. So that is sort of the history. So we really serve as a vehicle for all nonprofits in the state. As far as the logistics, as Mr. Schrader indicated, we have a website, and nonprofits come to us. They request being evaluated for financing. We have a consultant, a financial advisory consultant, as well as bond counsel who vet each project. Our board is made up of 7 members who need to have a background, as Karen does, in construction. Other members have a background in finance. We are fortunate to have a couple of public sector finance officials, as well as people who are retired investment bankers on our board. They vet the projects. We make sure that it's financially feasible for the institutions. If they issue publicly rated bonds, they need to have 2 credit ratings that are investment grade. We don't really want to have junk bonds going out. And so that sort of limits some of the public borrowings to the stronger credits. We do private placements with most of the banks in the state, and that we're a little more lenient, obviously, on some of the credit quality, because it just depends on the organization and their relationship with the bank. But in both cases, bond counsel is able to look through the overall transaction and ascertain that the uses of the proceeds will be used for things that are considered available under for the nonprofits and is tax exempt. Does that give you flavor?
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have actually 2 questions. The first is whether or not Mr. Schrader is going to issue us a bond counsel opinion that going outside the state won't get us in trouble. We're looking forward to that letter. You don't have to answer that right now.
But he'll swear in his life.
But the question, we just left the Revenue Committee meeting where we had a lengthy discussion about tax-exempt issues and tax credits and things of that nature. This is a great opportunity for you to explain to us the cost to the state of a tax exemption. And I think I've had this discussion with I can't remember, Laura, if it was with you, but the issue is if we force these nonprofits to go to the real market, the non-tax-exempt market, there would be taxable financing and thus tax paid on the money paid by the not-for-profit in the system, and the state would get a return on that. But perhaps the folks that we extend this 501c3 exemption to wouldn't build the building. But we don't do that finding. We simply look at the 501c3 designation. We don't ask if they could pay for real financing. We extend this exemption to them without any more inquiry. Have I got it right so far?
Sort of. Through the chair.
Well,
why don't we have bond counsel say whether this is going to cause any problems first?
You know, under this legislation, with the technical amendments, there's not any issues there. And again, this is very carefully crafted, very different from what you see in Wisconsin, Colorado, and some other states in terms of not requiring. Other states don't require this nexus and this connection. So, I don't think, even given that these are conduit and pass through, I don't think there's any material risk of liability. I think this legislation is appropriately and carefully crafted to require that connection, and there, hence the oversight. So these borrowers are scrutinized by the board, by the treasurer's office. So I think this is, and again, it's a trend. So I think it's a very, very appropriate legislation for for the state. Laura, do you want me to talk about state tax exemption?
I'm going to talk about that, if that's okay. Sure. And then you can add.
Madam Chair, before we leave, Mr. Tripp, if I may. So if there was an error and we weren't supposed to do this, who is it that bears the responsibility? Is it that the federal exemption is lost? Because we're not going to give them a state exemption. What's the damage for getting it wrong? I mean, who cares?
Well, whenever a bond is issued, the role of bond counsel, what our firm, what we do, is we give two opinions, sometimes technically, I guess, three opinions. We say that the bonds are validly issued, and that means that we've complied with statutory and procedural requirements, so the bonds are valid obligations of the borrower and that limited obligation of the state. That's a condition to having the tax exemption, both the federal tax exemption and... Again, Oregon has a very limited, it's an exemption from personal income taxation. So unless you're subject to personal income taxation, the state tax exemption has very limited benefit. In fact, only when you've got publicly offered debt. Is that responsive?
Not quite.
Not quite?
Good follow-up.
Please. Sure.
So the issue is this legislation allows an offering that would build a building in Idaho.
Yes.
And so someone takes paper from Idaho because the payment's coming in from Idaho, or the bond itself is secured by, in some part, Idaho property.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing there are federal tax exemption benefits that cover the entire offering.
Correct.
And my question is, if we got this wrong, does that mean that who pays? Because what ends up happening, I'm guessing, is you don't, the debt's still perfectly good.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the tax exemption may not be. And so isn't it the party that holds the paper that ends up having to pay the tax that would be angry and upset at bond counsel or the legislature for trying to get this right, but we didn't?
Okay. With respect to the federal tax exemption, if that's messed up, there's multiple folks to go after depending on including bond counsel, because we gave an opinion that it's tax exempt. How if we got it wrong and it's a bad judgment in terms of the legal meeting the legal requirements for tax exemption, the liability comes back to bond counsel, and there's a liability there. If the tax exemption is lost because the borrower didn't comply with its covenants and didn't use the proceeds as they represented they would, then, of course, the borrower is going to be liable. But, of course, the investor is going to be very unhappy because they purchased this paper at X percent and, in fact, had to pay tax on it, so it should have been X plus 1%, 2%, whatever that number is.
But okay. through the chair, I'd like to amplify, yes. If this bill were to pass out-of-state projects, they will not get an Oregon state tax right. exemption on the bonds for the portion of the project that's from out-of-state. So we're not offering that up. As far as what's the value of tax exemption in general, because we offer it on state bonds, on local Oregon bonds, as well as nonprofits that are in Oregon. So all three categories get a state tax exemption. It's very difficult to quantify what the investor's really paying and, in essence, what you're missing out on. But we have our friends to the north. So when I sold GO bonds last week, as I told you, we had a certain interest rate. Well, Washington and we have the same GO credit rating. The state of Washington doesn't have a state income tax, and we do. So we look and see, well, at the same, you know, out the bond yield, what's the difference in interest rates we pay? And it's very minimal because we both have federal tax exemption on our bonds, but because they don't have a state tax exemption, we do. We basically get about in the neighborhood of about 15 to 25 basis points lower cost on our bonds because we have that state tax exemption. So mathematically, you could ballpark if you wanted to. That's the sort of the incremental value of whatever you're missing out on in terms of you know, the amount of money. That's what the value is to the nonprofits. Does that help? I mean, I can't do the math for you and exactly how many tax-exempt bonds there are and exactly how much interest was earned on those bonds, but I can just tell you that's the value to both nonprofits, to the state, and local governments is roughly about 0.15 to 0.25%. Okay? Does that help at all to do the math calc?
You're talking just about the Oregon...
The value of an Oregon state exemption.
I see. So, mm-hmm. I understand that piece. And
And I think you've answered the question.
Okay. Yeah. But I can't tell you, my bonds might be 3% bonds or 5% bonds or 6%. And so you'd have to know all the interest rates on all the bonds that you're not collecting any income tax on. So that's a bit tougher for me to tell you what the value is. But I can tell you that it's valuable in for Oregon nonprofits. They get the federal value of the tax exemption plus this incremental piece that we all collectively get because of our relatively high income tax rates.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lively.
Madam Chair, this may unfortunately reflect my age. I've been around a long time. And so as a result, I'm a little confused. So what's the role, if any, in the local government? So the entity in which these facilities are located, is there any role that the local government plays in this process? The reason I'm asking, and this is before more than 26 years ago, when I was mayor in the city of Springfield, we had to approve the authorization for McKinsey-Willamette Hospital, which was a nonprofit local community, to seek bonds. And it's so you can see I'm confusing these issues.
Through the chair and Representative Lively, no, you're not.
I'm not. Okay.
Throughout other parts of state statute, legislation authorizes local governments to also issue conduit revenue bonds.
Okay.
And so we have health facilities authorities throughout the state, and we have a number of jurisdictions that can issue industrial development bonds and other kinds of conduit bonds. OFA was created as a statewide entity, as Mike has mentioned. We offer very professional services. We offer ongoing training of nonprofits and the technical assistance that they'll need to manage both their tax liability as well as their securities disclosure responsibilities. So we like to think of ourselves as the issuer of choice. And I think we are. For many smaller communities, they may not realize that the IRS sees that they are the issuer, and there are ongoing responsibilities for them. So we might charge a little bit more than others, but I think we provide a superior service.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I just have one follow-up question to kind of the whole conversation. Should this legislation not pass, what percentage of projects do you have in the pipeline that wouldn't be able to proceed without this?
I think the healthcare projects tend to come in waves, and we've had with the electronic medical records demands and reimbursement, those things, we had a pretty good wave. But I mean, there's always a series of projects. I don't think we can predict which projects and which issuers will elect to do an Oregon issue with multiple state projects into a single bond issue as opposed to doing multiple issues. But we think this is an important tool so that we have this available to be it a healthcare system, be it a senior living operator as well. So I don't think we have anything in the hopper right now where we'd say, oh, this isn't going to come to OFA because they still have to issue their Oregon projects. But we think this is an important tool to have in our toolkit in terms of assisting the larger issuers. And then, of course, as discussed, the benefit of that is that allows us to do outreach to the smaller issuers and really subsidize those costs. As Laura said, that differential, if you're a service provider, a small school, a private school, or otherwise, the difference in paying 3% or 4.5% or 5% on a $3 or $4 or $5 million capital project is a huge hit on your budget. And so the ability to lower those costs, those transaction costs, through the benefits of our larger issuers is really key to continuing and sustain the SNAP bond program, which has really been a great success.
And I would concur. I can't really say that we won't still function well as an organization without this legislation. We do meet annually and have a strategic planning session, and we've really tightened up and improved our organization, and this is just the last thing on our wish list, if you will, in terms of the things we want to do to provide services in the state.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2492 and open a hearing on House Bill 2289. Mr. Brennan, talk to us about brownfield property.
I'll be Madam Chair. So House Bill 2289 comes to our committee as well with a subsequent referral to Committee on Revenue. This measure creates a tax credit for cleanup of brownfield property, a tax applicable to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2016, and before January 1st, 2022. It would take effect on the 91st day following the adjournment sine die. We have no amendments in hand at this point. Because it has subsequent approval to another committee, we have also not received a fiscal revenue impact statement on this measure.
All right. Thank you. We have a number of people who are signed up to testify on this bill. Let's see. We have first, I wonder if there's any particular order in which we should be going. Okay. Mr. Tucker, would you like to tee us up here?
Sure. Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and with me on this panel are Doug McCourt from Adder Wynn in the law firm in Portland, and Seth Otto from Mall Foster Longy Incorporated. I'm going to give you some brief overview comments, ideally brief, Seth will go next and talk to you about the tool that we're here to talk to you about today, and his firm has done analysis of the impact and return on investment of a tax credit for brownfield cleanup. And Doug will speak to some of the specifics of the bill and some amendments that are forthcoming. And then we have another panel of people that can speak to some of the other elements of the bill as well as personal experience in brownfield cleanup.
Great. So, thank you very much.
So, and I should very clearly state, I'm the lobbyist for Metro. However, I'm really not here representing Metro today. Metro happens to have been the organization that convened this Brownfields Coalition. And so I'm here just to give you an overview about that and a couple of brief comments. Really, I want to emphasize, this is a statewide coalition. You've got two pieces of paper that I've handed up there. One is this. Which is a one-pager about the coalition itself, and you can see it on the left side of the page, the breadth of the coalition itself. We've got representatives from the environmental community, the business community, nonprofits, government, and everyone in between. And this has been a year-long process. It's been a very rewarding process. We've had the coalition has grown organically as people have heard about it and asked to get involved because brownfields are a problem around the state and there's a lot of interest in trying to address them. The other piece of literature I've handed up there is something that we also distributed, though, in a little bit less unwieldy format, but the exact same content. In September, when there was an interim committee hearing on the general topic of brownfields. I didn't testify at that time, but this piece has been produced by Business Oregon, and I want to very clearly state on the record that Business Oregon is neutral on this bill today and on another bill that we have in the Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee that has a subsequent referral to your committee. But they produced this piece that gives a really good overview of the brownfields problem in the state, and I thought it would be, especially the map, just in the large folding out piece of paper that shows that there are brownfields in every community in the state, that's one of the reasons why this effort has generated as much interest as it has. I am not going to repeat all of the general overview information about the brownfields problem that we presented in the interim. Obviously, a couple of you weren't here then, and happy to chat with you about that. But I think it's better to get to the rest of the testimony. I'd just like to what you are looking at today is a bill to create a new tax credit. And I just want to make it very clear that we certainly understand the reality of this session and the fact that there is not enough money apparently at this point allocated to renew the existing tax credits, much less to create new ones. That said, we hope you will take a look at this potential tool on its own merits. It has a very strong return on investment, as at least according to the analysis that's been done, and which means that it would pay back the state and local governments that implement these cleanups with this tool in a relatively short period of time and could really be beneficial to communities around the state. So with that, I would just like to turn this over to my colleagues on the panel, and I may have another idea, something just critical to say, but I'll stop there. Thanks.
Mr. Otto, and by the way, this is a very familiar map. We've seen this many times.
Excuse me. Thank you. So my name is Seth Otto. I'm with the environmental consulting firm Moll, Foster & Alonji. We're the largest locally owned environmental consulting firm in Oregon. And we specialize in brownfield remediation, cleanup, assessment, and redevelopment. We work on projects around the state. And really, I think our breadth of experience around the state reflects the issue here a little bit. Again, a familiar map for you, the state of Oregon, and and the distribution of sites around the state. This is something that really is spread in every county and spread around, following logically our pattern of urban and human growth around the state. In addition to being eyesores and public health hazards, brownfields often represent a lost opportunity and a drag on the local economic development opportunities. Focusing energy on their remediation and redevelopment can have a huge catalyzing effect on communities of all size. Our firm has completed several studies over the last few years on brownfields, the scale and impact on the presence of brownfield properties in communities around the state. And I'm going to share some of that information. I've been asked to keep it brief, so if there are any follow-up questions, please feel free to ask. So one of the things I want to start off with is emphasizing this is not a Portland problem. You know, you might think of contamination and think of the Portland Harbor or something like that, but it really is spread throughout the state. In fact, of the 5,000 sites, approximately 5,000, that are in DEQ's cleanup site inventory, only about 16% are in Portland. So they're really around the state. Also want to point out that this is an issue that really, you know, even though environmental laws have been on the books for about 25 years or more, it remains an issue. NFAs, or no further action determinations, have been issued on only about less than a third of all sites in the cleanup inventory. So there's still a lot of work to do. And in recent studies, we've shown that the problem is actually growing. A lot of the low-hanging fruit has been addressed, but there are problems that are still reported, sites that are still brought into the inventory, and the rate of issuance of NFAs is not keeping up with the growth of new sites being brought into the cleanup inventory. So it's something that we need to address. We've looked at sites in Metro. We've studied extensively the impact of brownfields in the Metro urban growth area. We've looked at the impact of policy tools on redevelopment. We've also looked at Portland and the impact of brownfields on industrial land availability and industrial growth and economic development in that area. And most recently, we've completed two studies, one for Business Oregon on the impact of their programs over the last two decades, and the other on most recently for the Coalition on the impact and the potential benefit from investing in brownfield redevelopment around the state. And that's what I'll turn to next and hopefully help answer the question of why Oregon should invest in brownfield redevelopment. In 2014, we completed an evaluation of the economic impact of current state programs through DEQ and Business Oregon. We found that over 23 years that the state has been active, both as a regulator and investor, there's been a substantial return on investment. For every $1 invested by the state, public and private parties have leveraged that for an additional $116 for cleanup, assessment, and redevelopment of brownfields. So this is the catalytic effect I was talking about at the beginning. A recently completed study, in fact, the one for the Coalition that's still in draft, evaluated the impact of brownfields on the economic development potential in the state. We evaluated hypothetical redevelopment scenarios, employing model pro formas on targeted high-priority brownfields around the state. For those sites that show a narrow feasibility gap, so those sites that would benefit from something like a tax credit to put them over the line into a to pencil out, the potential impact was significant. So these are the 2,600 acres of those high-priority brownfield sites. You can see that the income, the outcome of redeveloping these could lead to up to almost 70,000 new jobs and almost $100 million in state income. This is from the Metro study, where we employed a model of, again, evaluating potential redevelopment on catalytic sites and then employing specific tools to see what that did to the model, to see what it did to the feasibility. And the outcome that we saw was also quite impressive. In Metro, for every $1 million invested through an income tax credit, the return was almost 8 acres redeveloped, 160 jobs generated, and $325,000 in income taxes generated. This is annually. So imagine over 3 years that $1 million is repaid. In Portland, the effect was even more dramatic, I think, due to the nature of the economy there. The return on investment there was 10 to 1. So in all cases, the return is clear and recognizable in a short period of time. I would just end by summarizing that brownfields are a statewide issue. They impact both urban and rural communities. I think I heard earlier some of the communities that you represent include Tigard, Coos Bay, Salem, Springfield, and Eastern Oregon. Is that in a Baker City area? Mm-hmm. So of those, four have applied for or received grants from the US EPA for brownfield assessment and cleanup. Baker City is an RFQ out on the street right now for brownfield cleanup for the Baker School District. So this affects everybody around the state. Many of the sites statewide have a feasibility gap, and it's associated with their market conditions and the cleanup costs. The public sector can play a role in helping to close that gap by addressing the remediation costs and providing a little bit of incentive to push them over the line. Thanks.
Thank you.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you, one of your slides there talked about the growth in the number of sites. And so the question I have is, are we creating new sites or are we still just discovering the old sites? And the reason I ask the question is, over the years, the environmental standards and things, a lot of things have changed. And I hope part of that's in relationship, that we've learned a lot during that time so that we're not creating these kind of sites. But when you showed that figure where the number of sites continues to grow, I'm just trying to get from a historical standpoint, is that still just based on there's still many out there we haven't really discovered or classified as brownfields versus that we're creating more as we go along because our rules aren't correct yet?
That's an excellent question. And there's really two ways that that happens. You hit on both of them. One is that the regulations change, and what was previously best practice is now all of a sudden not and a problem. And the second is that brownfields are discovered through transaction. So the growth in the economy, sure, movement of real estate, that's how you discover these problems.
Yeah. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Sure. We have Mr. McCourt. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
You're welcome, Chair. Can you hear me okay?
McEwen, yes.
McEwen. Uh-huh. Vice Chair Davis, representatives, members of the committee. My name is Doug McCourt. I'm a partner with the law firm Vader Wynn based in Portland, and I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2289 and to describe to you a brief summary of the amendments that you will see on this bill. I have a copies of my testimony. I'm not going to read it or go through it in detail, but it does provide you basically a snapshot of three things. Knowing the uphill battle we faced with tax credits in the Oregon legislature, why did we take this on in the first place? Second, what was it about this particular financial incentive that really was the best to address the problem that Seth and Randy did a good job of describing? Then third, what are some highlights of the amendments that really try to focus in and help us achieve our goals here? So briefly, what are we trying to do? Well, after looking across the United States at a variety of different types of programs, including 14 different states' existing laws for brownfield tax credits, and discussing a whole variety of options, both supporting existing state programs like the Business Oregon Brownfield Loan and Grant Funds, to other financial incentives, we settled on a tax credit primarily for the reasons that Seth outlined, that it is one of the most powerful tools to not only help speed up the process of spending on these sites for cleanup leading to redevelopment, but it is one of the best mechanisms for the highest ROI or highest rate of return on investment in terms of jobs, in terms of both tax and non-tax revenues, in terms of environmental improvement, And possibly, and you've seen this in your own communities, possibly most important, the spark that just one small business, whether it's in a rural area or an urban area, can have on that, you know, street in Reedsport or in Baker or wherever it is that just is lagging behind, and in particular that old gas station site that nobody wants to touch. But once somebody does something with it, it starts to compound and flourish. So knowing that, again, we faced some challenges with tax credits, our goals with this tool, as it is with the other bill that Randy mentioned, really kind of fall into four categories. One, it's got to serve a critical financial need that's not currently met by any existing state or local program. Two, it's got to build on and leverage existing state programs, not duplicate them. Three, it's got to provide the maximum amount of benefits in the scale of other types of financial, regulatory, and structural incentives. And again, that's in terms of revenue generation, job creation, environmental restoration, and economic development. And lastly, it's got to minimize the economic and just labor burden for the state agency that's being asked to administer this, in this case, the Oregon Department of Revenue, as well as the taxpayers of the state. So a couple of brief features of why House Bill 2289 does that and why the amendments make it better. The first thing, the main thing it does, is it allows for a tax credit for 50% of eligible costs claimed in the tax year in which the costs were incurred. And I'll describe what those eligible costs are briefly. It allows for the transfer of tax credits in recognition of the additional financial burdens that these brownfield projects have, and in particular putting the financial package together with a variety of investors, lenders, and other kind of incentives that are a little bit outside the box because of the risks that are engaged in these sites. In the bill, eligible costs must exceed 25% of the assessed value of the brownfield site, and the result of that is that we weed out those sites that would go anyway. You know, we're not here to duplicate the market. We're getting those sites that would remain contaminated and undevelopable, and make those, plug those into the eligibility. Now, as you will hear in more detail from some of the later testimony, there's a bonus. There are a series of bonus credits that can take one above 50% of the eligible costs spent in that tax year, but of course below 100%, for certain measurable additional benefits, including the use of minority and women business enterprises who conduct the cleanup work, the creation of affordable housing, and we've got a specific definition for that, cleanup work conducted on a brownfield in a verified low-income community, creation of permanent open space, and the construction of new healthcare facilities in areas designated as having significant unmet healthcare needs. The amendments to House Bill 2289 add an additional bonus for the creation of at least 5 permanent full-time jobs with pay at least as much as the state or county average, and where at least $500,000 is invested in the brownfield site. The amendments clarify that only owners and operators of brownfield sites, as defined under existing law to ORS 465-200, are eligible to apply for the credit. The amendments further clarify that the owner-operator of the brownfield site, and this, I think, is this took up most of the debate in our finance committee over the last year, and in particular as we got down to the wire on this, as to really who should be eligible and how do we weed out, really, if there are any of the bad actors that shouldn't really, you know, get a financial credit from the state. In order to be eligible, the entity has to submit a notarized affidavit or declaration to the Department of Revenue, similar to other types of tax incentive programs that they run. And there's three elements of that. First and foremost, the applicant cannot be responsible for causing, contributing to, or exacerbating contamination at the site. Second, the applicant is participating in a Department of Environmental Quality supervised cleanup program or activity through a binding voluntary agreement or an order, and conducting a removal or remedial action. Again, those are terms defined in our cleanup law. And third, the applicant is in compliance with that order. And we had a lot of discussion around how to get to the right sweet spot there, and that eligibility criteria not only takes out people that are under enforcement for failing to do the right thing, but takes out the folks that really should have done it in the first place and aren't doing it. So House Bill 2289 authorizes the Department of Revenue to recapture the department's full cost of administering the program, including reviewing and verifying the application and recovering any credit later determined by the department to be based on fraud or misrepresentation. The amendments to House Bill 2289 simplify the process by which the Department of Revenue determines the necessary information for the application and which the department sets the fees. Legislative Council had originally suggested quite a lot of detail there. We thought it was probably better just to let the department figure that out. We'll see how that works out. And the amendments also clarify that in addition to bankruptcy trustees and lenders, local governments who are transferred a tax credit by acquiring a brownfield site either involuntarily through foreclosure or through eminent domain are not subject to losing that tax credit if, in fact, revocation proceedings are initiated by the Department of Revenue because they're fulfilling their public function. Finally, the amendments authorize the Department of Revenue to roll over successful applicants to a subsequent tax year in the event that they simply run out of capacity, that they meet the cap. And we tried our best through discussions with a variety of stakeholders, including revenue, to not only hit a very modest structure looking at everything that happens across the United States from, you know, apply for whatever you spend to very small amounts, but also trying to set a cap that's realistic given the limitations we have, you know, for tax credits in this legislature. So in conclusion, on behalf of the Oregon Brownfields Coalition, I urge the committee to accept the amendments that will be proposed and pass on House Bill 2289. I'm happy to answer any other questions. I've provided my contact information there if you have any.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
I don't have any questions. I guess I was just Senator a short McCain. Statement. This has taken 25 years for groups of folks to get to this point, and I think it's a pretty impressive group of coalition members on this one sheet that we got. And you know, they started inventorying all the way back in 1990, and it really does. This whole concept really provides, I think, an opportunity for the state economy as well as the state environmental community to come together on an issue that they both care about, mm-hmm. and that is providing for using less land, using land that's challenged, but using it in a way that we are accomplishing both economic issues and economic goals as well as environmental goals and environmental cleanup. I like the amendments that you brought in front of us. I hope to see those in writing somewhere. I can't find them, but they're probably on OLIS, so I'll just go right back and look again. But I think that you're getting to the point where we are basically going to try and benefit folks that really have been good actors and folks who really can provide for good leadership in the future. This is an ongoing 100-year project, and certainly something that we'll have to continue to figure out how to refine. But I really appreciate the basic foundational information that you gave today.
Thank you very much, Representative McLean. Chair McEwen, the one comment I would like to make, well, two points. One is going directly to your note. The reason you don't have those in front of you is that this is truly one of the broadest. I've been doing this for 25 years. This is one of the broadest coalitions that I've ever participated in to try to do something like this. And as you can imagine, its breadth makes decision-making a little bit challenging. Yeah. But that is part of the strength of the process. We have the spectrum goes from Associated Oregon Industries to the Audubon Society and everybody in between. And so that's we're in the process of refining those now. One last point, I'll go back to the very beginning of Randy's comments, and that is last January I was a part of, well, I'm on the board of the Northwest Environmental Business Council, and we held a session at our firm to look back at the interim session and what happened in the regular session on environmental bills and looking forward to what we really needed to do. We went to Metro, not because this is a Metro sponsored legislation or because it's a Metro idea, but because really plain and simply they had the staff and the resources to organize this coalition and help run it, but to make it broad. So it, as Randy said, this isn't a Metro proposal.
Thank you.
And Representative McLean, to your point, this is a rather the scope of the supporters is breathtaking. So we do appreciate the good work that you're doing.
Madam Chair, may I just make one final comment? Yes, don't look on OLIS yet, Representative
McLean.
We're
not seeing anything. Keep looking, and I'm not seeing anything in there.
And I just wanted to provide one last piece of context. As I already said, there's another bill in another committee, and the point I want to make is that every brownfield is different, and no one tool is the silver bullet that's going to solve them all, including this one, even though we believe this is a tool that have a lot of impact. And so, that's why we have another bill. And the other thing is that it's not just the state's responsibility. There's a local responsibility as well. This bill focuses on the state's role. However, the other bill that hopefully will be coming to you soon, it's House Bill 2734, that one would create some tools for local governments to use that wouldn't be costing the state any money. Those would be optional tools that local governments could use with their own resources in order to address this problem. So thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We have four others who have signed up to testify. We can do two and two, or we can bring you all up at once. What would you suggest, Mr. Brennan?
Two and two.
I would like to call Amy, and Amy, I'm not going to get this correct. Thank you. I appreciate that. And Jen Bildersee, City of Portland? Ms. Bildersee? Are you a team? Then come on up together. That would be fine.
Chair McCone, Vice Chair Gorsuch, and members of committee, thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of probably some of the stakeholders in brownfields. My collective
for the record, your name, please.
Amy Subirian.
Thank you.
My collective experiences that I have gained over the last 22 years as an environmental consulting engineer, over the past 10 years as a brownfields owner, and over the past 8 years as a small business owner, gave a depth of knowledge on what it takes to revitalize brownfield properties. Not just remediate and rebuild, but to revitalize the business potential once they have had. As you know, most of these properties used to be small businesses or businesses, commercial or industrial sites. And they're all in all real excellent locations. You ask any developers where you want to develop, it's location, location, location. So they were tax-paying businesses, but their status has changed due to real or perceived liability associated with these properties. About 10 years ago, I took over a small abandoned gas station, a dead eyesore site in the heart of Beaverton community. That's where I used to live for 22 years, and transformed it to become a community gathering place. And the business is an upscale coffee house, community-based coffee house. Our Roasteria is the name of the business. Today, our Roasteria is a tax-paying job creating a small business that is expanding. We are going to have 5 locations by the end of this year, which translates to creating 60 direct full-time jobs. I don't know how many indirect, probably half of that a month, and generates a significant amount of tax revenue for local, state, and federal government. I can tell you this. When I started this business, I would lose sleep over paying payroll. Now I'm losing sleep over paying how much taxes I have to pay.
A good problem to have.
Yes, yes, exactly. This is all started from a seed money from a revolving loan, basically, from the Business Oregon Brownfields program, which made it possible to manage environmental liability, which I was able to go to conventional banks and get financing for redevelopment, and also working capital to start a small business. This small brownfields revitalization project had a huge impact on local economy. It has changed the city of Beaverton's vision. It was a catalyst to boost economic growth of adjacent properties, even during recession. We started the business in 2006. In 2008, just next to our business, when all the housing developments were down the drain, we had about 12 condominium built, and it was all gone in 1 month. They were all sold after they were built. Sadly, stories like ours, their success, are rare in our state and in nation. Why? Perhaps in part due to necessities to adjust and amend our brownfields regulations to promote such growth. As an engineer, I have learned no matter how many, how great of a design I generate, I always have to go back, revise and refine it to make sure we can implement it at the site, consult with the field technicians before going to the field. I believe that is before you today, the House Bill 2289, it's very much the same thing. Honestly, I'm not sure if what is being proposed is enough to overcome brownfields problem in our state, as Seth represented it, is we have a huge amount of inventory of the sites that can be redeveloped, but we need to do a lot more. This is just a step moving forward. As a brownfields developer and a business owner, I'm looking for opportunities to expand my business model, give small businesses like mine an incentive to consider brownfields development as an option. Our first store was built on a brownfield site, but the other four were persuaded by big developers who gave us incentives to take our business to their sites. With current regulations or settings, regulations, different financing problems, this is no-brainer that when it comes to cost and benefit analysis for a business owner, brownfield site constantly lose competing with alternatives. The state of Oregon, one of the things that brought me to the state of Oregon 30 years ago to go to a school at OSU was the fact that I saw state of Oregon was a pioneer in advancing environmental regulations since 1951. That was when the first piece of environmental legislation was enacted to regulate air pollution. I'm looking forward to decisions these days for brownfields redevelopment and revitalization and incentives that the state can provide. That once again, we pioneer this legacy and make our state one of the first states to make those kind of tax benefits, tax incentives. I don't know if we have time, but I have done a little bit of research. I'm actually doing a research at Oregon State University right now and finding out what are the enablers and what is basically preventing brownfields from development.
But I think we would all be delighted if you would pass that information to our committee staff, and we'll be happy to take a look at it.
Sure, no.
Thank you.
Then I'm done. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for staying in Oregon, and thank you for your entrepreneurial spirit and your willingness to work through what can be a very complex system. Had we an unlimited checkbook, we would be doing a lot more of this work because we do understand the importance of it. Unfortunately, we work under certain constrained environments at times. But this is a significant topic of conversation. And those of us who are interested in industrial development, which I think a number of us on this panel certainly are, you're speaking to a receptive audience. So thank you
for your time.
Questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Please.
Representative McEwen, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Jen Bildersee. I'm representing the City of Portland today. I'm the Brownfield Coordinator for the City of Portland. It's a pleasure to go after Amy to really remember the end game, the goal that we are all working towards. As you've heard, brownfields are an ongoing challenge in Oregon and a tremendous opportunity. And they require that initial investment in order to provide return. And that is what 2289 accomplishes and why I'm here to express support for it today. This is a really new and powerful tool for Oregon. It's a tool that many other states have implemented to great success. And one advantage to not being the first in the game is we've been able to look at their experiences and learn from them in developing our course forward. Being on this coalition, which there have been comments about the breadth of this coalition, one thing is clear, there are no opponents of brownfield cleanup. We have some heated discussion about the details, but everyone wants brownfields cleanup. It creates jobs. It returns long vacant blighted sites to the tax rolls. It improves communities. It improves the environment. It protects water quality. It improves human health. The list goes on and on. So many of us are here for different reasons, but we've all agreed that this is an important tool. My specific role today in this group is to talk a bit about the support for the bonuses. Doug McCourt went through those very quickly, and it seems like you don't have those in front of you, so I will just go through one more time briefly, because there are six of them, and then if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. So again, the core credit is for 50% of the cleanup costs incurred, but there are opportunities to receive a credit for up to 100% of costs. Again, no site, even if you accomplished all of the bonuses, would go over 100% of the cost. And it would be an additional 25% of costs for brownfield projects that meet one of six identified needs. And those are sites where the cleanup is accomplished by minority women business enterprises. Second, brownfield cleanups that happen in high poverty neighborhoods. Third, brownfield redevelopments that result in affordable housing. Fourth, brownfield remediation that results in permanent parks and open space. Fifth, brownfield redevelopments that result in a healthcare facility in an area that has been identified as having an unmet healthcare need. And finally, there's a bonus that is tied specifically to new job creation. The intention in this list, it comes from the fact that brownfields come in many different shapes and sizes. There are very large industrial sites throughout the state, waterfront sites, mills, factories. But there are also many, many of these commercial sites, old gas stations, old dry cleaners on every main street and commercial corridor in every city and town in Oregon. And so there's not just one tool that's going to work for all of them. And some of them have more barriers than others. And the list of bonuses has really been shaped in order to support a wide range of projects. Brownfields are an economic opportunity issue. They're an environmental justice issue, and the bonuses are designed with that in mind as well. And they were really crafted carefully with the input of our broad coalition. As Seth Otto mentioned, numerous communities throughout Oregon have been independently trying to come up with tools and sources of investment for brownfields over the past decade. Salem and Springfield and Troutdale and Astoria and Tigard, the list goes on again, have recognized that brownfields are an important place to invest. And what 2289 does is really provide a statewide tool that can be really powerful for accomplishing our goals. Thank you again for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I have a question. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for the work that you do. I'm just curious, if you represent Portland, are there other representatives across the state that then work with other cities and counties, communities? How do we, do folks just reach out to a certain group? How does that work if they're interested in finding out about that?
Chair McEwen, Representative Hack, thank you for your question. The Oregon brownfield community is becoming smaller, particularly with this coalition effort. There are certain federal sources of funding, and Environmental Protection Agency offers certain sources of funding, and a number of communities over the past few years have reached out for that funding, and we are all very supportive of each other. So I know who my brownfield colleague in Salem is. I know who my brownfield colleague in Springfield is, and again, on and on. We are working together to try and develop tools and to try and plug each other in. It's not an area where competing with each other is going to be helpful, and I think we've all come to recognize that. We're really trying to grow the pool of resources. We're facing common obstacles, and we're trying to be inventive to come up with tools together that are going to work statewide.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Jason Miner. I'm the executive director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thanks so much for this opportunity to testify in support of HB 2289 and the larger efforts of this coalition to work to help promote legislation to clean up brownfields. It's truly an honor to work with this coalition. Several years ago, as I was working within the city of Portland and other jurisdictions where we work, asking how we can get more involved in this problem, I heard a constant refrain that there were many, many interested, but a lack of individuals willing to step up and take a leadership role that really coalesced a broader community. We came to this coalition, this specific coalition, in the middle of the summer, and I think we found a group of people working together where that leadership role has really been taken on, not by a single entity, but by everybody in the coalition, trying to make sure that we are not only working to clean up brownfield sites and promote mechanisms for cleaning up brownfield sites, but actually getting it to issues of how do we promote community priorities as redevelopment occurs. That's one of the things that I'm most excited about in this work. As Jen mentioned, and the reason that we are a duo in singing the praises of this bill is the bonus structure built in highlights communities and highlights sites that may not otherwise get attention. In doing the work of 1,000 Friends of Oregon in working on land use policy, I often think about Roseburg and Glide. My wife graduated from Roseburg High School, and we spent a lot of time up and down the Umpqua River Valley. And I often have gone through Glide, and she wrote a very good article about Glide, the state that timber built. If you ever get a chance to read read the Oregon Historical Quarterly, it's my wife's profile of the community of Glide. And I look at the underdeveloped sites, or the brownfield sites in both Roseburg and Glide, and I often wonder, what's our work doing for these communities? When I look at the bonus structure that's built into this, this proposed legislation, sites of providing bonuses for cleanup and sites of census tracts with high poverty, I think of those places. As we work and continue to work together as a coalition, I hope that you'll join in championing the work of this group. As I mentioned at the outset of my comments, it's the broadest coalition of entities that I'm involved in on pretty much any issue. I appreciate your taking the time to hear our testimony, and I think, to quote Amy, that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miner, for being here. Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, and I'm very happy to see the group together. Thank you so much for your taking that risk. Mm-hmm. It was considerable. I'm guessing there are moments when you really wish you hadn't.
No, if there is a risk, there is opportunity too, and I'm enjoying the opportunities now.
So my remarks are really directed to 1,000 Friends and the interesting dynamic that you create by preventing the expansion of places outward, by putting a circle around these cities and saying you can't expand and put industrial land out here until you clean up the mess inside the circle. And what ends up happening, of course, is nothing. And that's been the case for a long time. I know in this committee some years ago, we looked at the dearth of industrial parcels in our most important economic hub, Portland, and we found very, very few that weren't brownfields. And of course, there's no possible way, unless you come to this body, the legislature, that we could get outside that circle. You can try, but you guys do a wonderful job of preventing it. And it seems to me that the consequence is that we have to get together, as this bill so wonderfully illustrates, and figure out a way of paying for the cleanup, because we sure can't get outside that boundary. And so I wonder just how wealthy a community has to be to enjoy this type of luxury, to delay expanding our base of economic activity while we struggle to put together arrangements like this. In the meantime, opportunity goes begging. Now, Portland's and Hillsboro, well, that area is lucky, lucky, lucky. You have enormous opportunity for various reasons. Roseburg and Glide and Ontario and Vail, Burns, other places aren't so lucky. And in fact, they don't have the money for either the cleanup or the ability to pay to escape the circle that's around them. So I'm happy to see on that list. I'm happy to see you here today. I'm happy to share my thoughts with you. And I hope that working together, we can figure out some way to better address the problem that I think in large part is created by ourselves, both the circle and the mess that we're trying to clean up.
Thank you, Representative Bentz. Thank you. Thank you, Chair McKeown.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Well, we will look forward to a work session on this bill at some point in the future. We'll look forward to the amendments coming. And we'll excuse this panel. I believe we have one more person signed up to testify. Mr. Salvaggio, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, Chair, if I may, while Mr. Salvaggio is coming up, I should note we also have received testimony that is on OLIS from the City of Beaverton Association of Oregon Counties, Multnomah County, and the City of Salem on this measure.
So you can take a look at those and read them at your leisure. I'm sorry you have to testify all by yourself, Mr. Salvaggio.
Very lonely up here.
Welcome to our panel.
Chair McCune, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio. I'm up here representing the Audubon Society of Portland and its 15,000 members. And Audubon recognizes that brownfield cleanup is a significant environmental equity and economic concern. We are thrilled that this work is being done. It's important to create mechanisms to promote this type of cleanup of contaminated sites. We've participated in the Metro-led work group to help develop this legislation, and we support many elements of it. We're particularly thrilled about the effort to create incentives to use remediated brownfield sites to address issues of community concern, as we heard, such as affordable housing, open spaces, job creation, and those others. However, I want to put on the record that there are several outstanding concerns that do keep us from a full endorsement of the legislation at this time. We do hope that these issues are addressed through an ongoing discussion. That discussion is happening currently, and as you heard, there is an amendment in the works or possibly at some various level of completion. And I do hope that that addresses some of what I'm about to bring up. The concerns include five general areas at this point. The broadness of the tax credits, we had expressed a concern that being available to parties subject to enforcement actions would mean that the limited resources available would be ineffectively applied to be available when the state and federal government have already enforced cleanup actions at the expense of owners, and that means that less money is available for voluntary cleanup. Again, that's something that may or may not be addressed already through the amendments that that we'll hopefully be seeing very soon. We do think that we want this to be limited to cleanup actions. Again, a matter of efficacy regarding your limited resources. We want to make sure that things like remedial investigations or other procedural steps are not financed at the expense of more effective active cleanup efforts. We do want to ensure that small brownfield sites can compete with larger, possibly more well-heeled sites. We would like to see at least a portion to be set aside for smaller acreage sites. We also have an outstanding question as to whether applicants should be eligible for 100% of the cost recovery. We understand and we've supported the idea that there's these bonuses in place, but there's also something to be said for the owners having some skin in the game, and believe that they should at least cover some part of those costs. And lastly, some concerns expressed regarding the validation process to ensure that applicants are actually engaged in those binding and enforceable cleanup options. And I hope that we have further discussion on that. And again, this is something that I'll look very, very forward to reading the amendments and see how well that's been addressed in whatever amendments come out. We do appreciate all the work that's been done to this point. We are very, very eager to continue this discussion. Again, this is an important issue for many reasons. We just want to make sure that as this is done, it's done in a way that best protects the interests of the community. So to paraphrase an oft-repeated phrase in this building, good effort should amend.
A very succinct way to end the conversation on this bill today. Thank you, Mr. Salvaggio. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Salvaggio? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room that did not sign up that would like to speak to this issue today? Seems as though we've covered our bases. On that note, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2289, and I will turn to Mr. Brennan to talk to us about what we can expect on our agenda for Wednesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have two public hearings up for Wednesday. Both are related to veterans' issues. One is dealing with roadside memorials, another dealing with Gold Star license plates. So they're both transportation-related veterans and fallen hero issues. And then we also have a work session scheduled for two bills from last week, House Bill 2437, which we heard on Monday, and House Bill 2279, which we heard on Wednesday.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything for the good of the order? note, we will adjourn 17 minutes early. How about that? We will adjourn 17 minutes early. How about that? On that note.